valves. 3 years later, someone else came up with a suspiciously similar technology. I thought of taking legal action, but what was the point? Bettina never came back to me. I returned to medical research. Developed a lightweight heart-lung connector. I was given a knighthood in 1989, so I've nothing to complain about. But when I was told that Hamish Melville was about to be portrayed as the saviour of mankind, I felt it was time to tell my side of the story. There was silence in the room. Mabbott scribbled furiously. His shorthand was rusty, and it took him a while to catch up. By the time he'd finished, Trickett had got to his feet, and it was clear that he was not keen on having Mabbott in the house a moment longer. Mabbott noticed that his eyes were misty, owing perhaps to the effort of recall. "May I ask you—"
"If you don't mind, Mr. Mabbott, I have many other demands on my time."
"I'm sure. Your long experience must be valuable." He waved his hand as if swatting a fly.
"Yes, there are always people who want to get in touch."
He shuffled across the hall. "Still busy?" asked Mabbott, following.
"Isn't that? Brain like mine can never stop thinking."
They had come to the front door.
"Well, thank you for seeing me."
Mabbott felt in his back pocket and handed Trickett a card, more out of duty than expectation.
"That's my number, Sir Victor, if you ever need to call me."
Trickett took it without a glance and dropped it into a dusty bowl beside the telephone. Then he drew aside a heavy protective curtain and pulled open the door. They squeaked across the gravel towards the car.
"I'll go ahead, open the gate for you," said Trickett.
"May I ask you one more thing, Sir Victor?"
Trickett stopped and turned. Mabbott was aware that he was on delicate ground. He couldn't just say he thought the man was a confused old fraud.
"You'll understand that I need to be very thorough when dealing with accusations such as this. Is there anyone else who can corroborate your story? Your wife, maybe?"
Trickett shook his head.
"My wife died 10 years ago."
Mabbott closed his notebook and was about to get into his car when Trickett said,
"There is someone who knew her."
Mabbott sighed inwardly and pulled out his notebook again.
"And who would that be?"
For a moment, Trickett stared down at the gravel. Then he looked up, but not at Mabbott, at a point somewhere behind him. He moistened his lips.
"Her daughter. Ursula's her name. But she's not in this country. Last thing I heard, she was in Czechoslovakia."
Mabbott wrote this down and looked back at Trickett. "Second name?"
"Galina."
"Ursula Galina," he repeated, writing it down.
"Well, thank you. But don't you want the surname?"
"I'm sorry, I thought that was it." Trickett shook his head, and his face betrayed the merest glimmer of a smile.
"Ursula Galina Melville."
Chapter 6. The spa town of Karlovy Vary sat prettily in a steep wooded valley. It had been known as Carlsbad for most of its working life, but was renamed at the end of the Second World War, when the Germans who had lived there on and off for 5 centuries were expelled, and the town became part of Yugoslavia, then Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic. As Mabbott walked down from the station, he had a feeling of unreality, of having walked into a Grimm Brothers fairy tale. The houses huddled steeply together, the onion-domed towers, the deep-pitched roofs and pink-washed walls could all have been made of gingerbread. The place reminded Mabbott, quite poignantly, of a holiday he had once enjoyed with Christina in the mountain villages of southern Poland. It was the first time they'd left the children since they were born. Out of the context of work and home, it had been a magical week. Christina used to say that she never wanted to go back to Poland because she'd never be as happy there again. He reached the fast-running river that twisted along culverts through the town and walked across a bridge to a picturesque riverside strip filled with tourists. Some were shopping for glass and trinkets. Others were being carried round in coaches drawn by ponies with red caps on their ears. Portly waitresses in big skirts brought trays of coffee and chocolate to those who were taking late lunches or early teas outside on the cafe terraces. Beneath a long classical colonnade, groups of the elderly were waiting in line to take the famous healing waters. Mabbott found a table and ordered a coffee. He still had Christina on his mind, so he took out his notebook and flipped through the last few pages, trying to concentrate on the job in hand. It was 24 hours since he'd seen Trickett. It was a visit he'd found disturbing for many reasons. That the man had failed to show up on his radar was clearly an omission on his part. On the other hand, there had been something odd about it all. Why had this highly confidential and potentially explosive information surfaced only now? He'd missed it, but then so at first had Latham's team of researchers, who'd supposedly been working on the Melville file for 6 months. The coffee arrived, a plume of milk still vibrating gently on its surface. Mabbott had never met any of Latham's researchers. He'd been told they were interns, young graduates hoping for a permanent foothold in the publishing business. On the odd occasions when he wanted information from them, he'd had to go through Latham. And then there was Trickett himself, hardly the most convincing witness. A sad, bitter old man who didn't want his name to be mentioned. Mabbott's hunch was that there was some chicanery here, something that fitted uncomfortably well with Latham's determination to change the tone of the book. Mabbott felt he had to catch up, to try to win back the initiative before it all got out of hand. He had to check out the credibility of Trickett, and he had to check out the existence of this Ursula Melville before anyone else got to her. There had not been much to go on, a name and a country. Apart from an 85-year-old radio actress called Ursula Melville, Mabbott had drawn a complete blank. He'd been about to give up when, after tapping in her full name, Google had asked whether he'd meant Galena Health Products. Mabbott had idly clicked again, and this time he sat up. Galena Health Products were produced at a clinic in the Czech Republic. The address was Stará Luka, Karlovy Vary. No telephone or email was given. It was a wild card, a hunch, but he hadn't been able to let it go. Mabbott finished his coffee, left the money beneath the saucer, and walked across the plaza to a quiet street of boutiques in tall 19th-century houses painted in vibrant shades of green, red, pink, and blue. It wasn't a long street, and at number 19, Mabbott found the nameplate he was looking for. Galena Center for Health and Beauty. It was in English. He buzzed and was admitted. Inside, everything was cool, white, and minimalist. He'd heard about these private sanatoriums. Largely catering to wealthy Russians, they capitalized on the publicly available mineral waters to offer highly private therapy, expensive, exclusive, exhaustive, and dedicated to making the rich feel better. Stairs led up to a first-floor reception area. Mabbott found himself in a long, bright room with tan leather sofas and walls hung with framed photos of bodies beautiful. It was an anaesthetized, strangely depersonalized environment, which could hardly be more different from anything one would associate with Hamish Melville. Through force of habit, or perhaps just to make it quite clear that he was not here for a beauty treatment, Mabbott reached into his pocket and took out his notepad. As he did so, he caught a glimpse of himself in the tinted mirror behind the reception desk, looking old and furtive, like some elderly detective on his last job. The receptionist was impeccably complexioned, with the pale, immaculate face of a doll. She smiled as best she could.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm looking for a Ms. Melville.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Melville. Ursula Melville.
We don't have anyone of that name here.
This is the Galena Clinic.
Center, yes.
I was told that Ursula Melville worked here. She looked puzzled.
I don't think so, no.
Mabbott was treading water now, about to kick himself for the whole absurd adventure, when the receptionist's face showed a glimmer of recognition.
There is an Ursula Weitz.
Can I see her?
Who shall I say is calling?
Mabbott was about to reply when he experienced an almost out-of-body experience. The door behind the receptionist swung open, and he found himself face to face with a tall, imposing woman with a head of golden hair. Instantly, he knew who it was. The shrewdness of the eye, the briskness of the glance, the effortless composure. It was as if Hamish himself stood there, albeit white-gowned, full-bosomed, and 40 years younger. So when the woman spoke in a soft German accent, He was momentarily confused.
Yes, sir. How can I help?
The receptionist gestured redundantly.
This is Miss White.
It's pine extract with the zest of lemon.
Mr. What was the name again?
Mabbott. Keith Mabbott.
Do you like it?
Very nice, Mabbott lied, as he took the first sip of the tea.
They were sitting together in Ursula Weitz's office. The walls were lined with photographs of those who had been treated there, or rather those who had been treated and were happy to have their photographs taken. Mabbott recognised one or two world leaders, and others he was less sure about, actors, sportsmen and women, television celebrities, all wearing the same impenetrable smiles. Smiles like masks, concealing the anxieties that had brought them to the clinic in the first place. Loss of looks, loss of attraction, loss of the power to seduce and beguile. The awkward initial introductions were over, and despite the fact that her existence was a potentially lethal discovery for his book, there was something about Ursula Weitz that gave Mabbott hope. An openness, perhaps. A lack of Trickett's bitterness.
I know who my father is, but I don't have any contact with him. I must have met him when I was a baby, but I don't remember anything. My mother, Bettina, she married my stepfather, Felix.
Felix Weitz. She nodded.
Yes. They married when I was 5 years old. I have two stepsisters and a stepbrother, and we are all one big family. But my mother always told me the truth. She had to. I was half a meter taller than everyone else.
Ursula laughed, a loud, unladylike laugh, bracingly out of place in such a controlled environment.
And your stepfather, did it worry him?
She shook her head vigorously.
He was too busy making money. He loved to play the markets. He was like a child. When Germany reunited, he bought everything he could in the East, companies that no one else would touch. Within 10 years, they were all making a profit. So he sold them and went looking around the old Soviet republics.
She chuckled at some memory.
He had this energy, you know. He would come home from, I don't know, Azerbaijan, and tell us how he had bought an oil company because he was the only one who could drink and stay awake. Is he still alive?
No.
He was quite a bit older than my mother.
Mabbott hesitated.
I'm probably out of line here, but do you ever think about meeting up with your real father?
I have my business to run here. We're opening a spa in Berlin next year. I have a partner who I've been with for 5 years. My life is my life. Why complicate things?
Yes, I understand.
May I ask, did your mother talk much about her first husband?
She talked about my father a lot.
Only a man called Victor Trickett claims that not only did Melville steal your mother, he also stole some important designs for heart valves which belonged to Trickett. Did she ever mention this?
Ursula frowned.
What was the name again?
Victor Trickett.
Sir Victor Trickett. I don't remember her saying anything, no.
She never talked about artificial hearts, heart valve patents, anything like that?
She shook her head. I'm sorry, that means nothing to me.
They talked for a while about this and that, but then a buzzer went on her desk. Ursula spread her hands apologetically.
It's my oligarch. He's on his way.
She slid open a drawer, took out a card, and examined it.
4 hours, 4 therapists.
She got to her feet. That sounds good for you.
It's good money, but he thinks it entitles him to put his hands wherever he likes, and our therapists don't do that.
So what do you do?
I bring in some girls from outside. I give them an hour's training and tell them that if they keep quiet, they can keep the tips.
And what do you tell him?
Ursula shrugged.
He never complains. He's 94. He won't be coming here much longer.
Mabbott smiled at her and held out his hand.
Thanks for your time, Miss Weitz. I'm sorry to have to ask you these things.
I understand.
He's a great man, your father. It was a privilege spending time with him. He was halfway through the door when Ursula called after him. Mr. Mabbott. He turned. How about a realignment massage? On the house, of course. You look as though you could do with one.
Chapter 7 Mabbott had never felt particularly comfortable in private clubs. He'd been lunched at the Garrick once, and one of his better sources in the arsenic story had been a member of the Reform, but he'd never been invited in. On this bright spring morning, as he turned off St. James's and walked up the steps to the bow-windowed façade of White's, he tried hard to remember that all men were equal, and some women too, as his father used to say. Rex Naismith, dressed in a light grey three-piece, was waiting for him at the bottom of a wide, curving staircase, his bulk disguised by excellent tailoring. Rex greeted Mabbott and suggested they go on up to the dining room and have a drink there. At various tables, Mabbott recognised the broad backs, well-filled stomachs, and faintly familiar profiles of political life gone by. Rex ordered two glasses of the house white, and they ate herring and beetroot salad. They talked, neutrally, about the club, its history, the portraits on the walls, and the impossibility of finding a restaurant as quiet as this anywhere else in the centre of London. Then there was a good but slightly tough New Zealand lamb to be dealt with, as Rex effortlessly spun gossipy anecdotes about some of their fellow diners. It was not until the table had been cleared and the cheese trolley dismissed that Mabbott began to explain to Rex why he'd asked to meet him. He described, as fully as possible, his predicament over the Melville book and the recent revelations about Sir Victor Trickett, though, of course, he didn't mention him by name. Rex, it was said, knew everything about everybody, so Mabbott asked whether he was aware that Melville might have had secrets, been involved in adulterous affairs and business betrayals. Rex was confidently dismissive. Melville was undoubtedly competitive and astute in matters financial, but he was absolutely not the sort of man to have taken a penny that didn't belong to him. On the other hand, he couldn't deny that Melville had always had an eye for the ladies and they for him. Mabbott said that this was also the view of all his sources. Charlie Murray had heard rumours of a love child, maybe even two. Mabbott smiled as he thought of Ursula. She'd turn a few heads in here. Emboldened by Rex's candour, Mabbott steered the conversation closer to home. I gather you and Christina are, well, seeing less of each other. Rex seemed taken aback. Not at all. We see each other regularly. My daughter seemed to think otherwise. For once, Rex had no reply. He pursed his lips and looked sideways at Mabbott for a moment. Your daughter and her mother are seeing less of each other. That's certainly true. Oh? Rex loaded a spoonful of sugar into his coffee and stirred. There was clearly more to be said. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here. Rex tapped his spoon on the rim of the cup and laid it carefully on the saucer. But there's a little friction between them at the moment. A friction? Over the boyfriend. You mean Shiraj? Shiraj, yes. Christina feels that Jay, and you to a certain extent, are being, well, a little overindulgent with him. Does that make sense? Mabbott gave a sigh of exasperation. I'm afraid Christina and the National Front have never been sworn enemies. That's not entirely fair. Well, put it this way, she's never had unlimited tolerance for non-nationals. Comes from being Polish. Rex ignored the jibe. I still think it's worth talking to her about it. Julia does belong to you both. Mabbott bristled. He was not going to be told how to treat his own daughter by this man. If she wants to talk to me, she knows where I am, he said briskly. Rex, ever calm, checked his watch. Well, I hope you don't mind my passing the message on. He held up his hand for the bill. I'll ask around about your informant, he added. Sounds pretty harmless to me. I wouldn't worry. Mabbott stared at the computer screen. He was left with an adulterous affair and an illegitimate child, and given what passed for sensation these days, it was pretty thin stuff. He could quite easily feed this into the text, but would it be enough to get Latham off his back? He set to work that night, and by 4:30 had come up with something that felt right. He would revisit it in the morning, and all being well, send Latham the relevant pages over the weekend. Then, hopefully, the whole thing could be put to bed, and he could get back to Albana. First thing on Monday, Scylla rang as Mabbott was emerging from the shower. Latham had read the latest version and wanted to meet them both as soon as possible. Unfortunately, one of her most promising new discoveries was at the Madrid Book Week, so she wouldn't be able to accompany him this time.
"Are you all right, Syl?" "Much better. Call me tonight. I shall be in the hotel around 9. And good luck, dear boy."
Mabbott treated himself to a taxi down to Urgent Books, arriving in good shape and, despite his earlier qualms, feeling quietly confident about the way he dealt with the Trickett story. Instead of talking in his office, Latham led Mabbott through to the boardroom. He motioned him in and briskly shut the door behind him. There was no offer of refreshment. He slapped the rewrites down on the table and indicated a row of chairs on the near side of the table. Mabbott sat down while Latham remained standing, his back to Mabbott.
"You've been busy, I gather. Trips to the continent."
Mabbott shrugged. "Just doing my job."
"I could have organized it all for you if you'd asked."
"I was lucky. Got a cancellation."
"And?"
"And I now know that he does indeed have an illegitimate daughter. I should have found that out earlier, but as you will have read, I've now included it in the text, with her name changed at her request."
Latham snorted. "And her story practically undetectable."
"There's nothing to it. It's no big deal."
"Well, that's a matter of opinion. What I'm more interested in is Trickett."
"I was down there first thing on Monday. Interesting man. A hermit knight." Latham tapped his finger rapidly on the pages before him.
"Did you listen to what he said?"
Mabbott paused a moment before answering. "He specifically asked not to be recorded, but I kept full notes, yes."
"Did he at any time mention mechanical heart valves?"
"He didn't go into technical detail, but yes, he mentioned that he had worked on something like that." Ron took a piece of paper from his jacket pocket and adjusted his glasses.
"He designed the first ever set of plastic bileaflet valves for use in heart operations.
But as I remember, he told me he couldn't finish the work."
"Because he didn't have the money, right?"
"That was it, yes. Melville offered to help him." Latham nodded.
"That was kind of Melville, wasn't it?"
"Very much in character." Latham pulled a chair from under the table and sat directly opposite Mabbott.
"What he did next was not in character, though, was it? And going off with Trickett's wife."
"Having an affair? That's hardly a character flaw."
"What about running off with a woman who took all the work her husband had done for the last 4 years and helping her sell it to the highest bidder?"
"That's not how Trickett described it. He said they worked jointly."
Latham shook his head angrily. "That is what he said. You just didn't hear it."
"How do you know you weren't there?"
"And you didn't hear it because you didn't want to hear it, because it looks bad for the man you hero worship."
"Look, I've written about his infidelity. I've written about his illegitimate daughter, who, incidentally, has never even met him, and who has never heard of Victor Trickett either. I've taken all that on board, and I delivered the rewrites to you in 3 days flat. I've kept my side of the bargain."
Latham took a deep breath and leant forward once again.
In the hard light of the halogen spotlights, Mabbott noticed a few drops of moisture on his forehead. When he spoke slowly.
"You have missed the big story, Keith. Whether Trickett deserved to lose his wife or not is not what matters. What matters is whether he deserved to lose his life's work, whether he deserved to see the man who took his wife grow rich on the proceeds of his genius. That's what matters."
"He didn't exactly say that."
"Well, he should have done."
The room rang with the sound of Latham's hand hitting the table. Then there was silence. Latham straightened up and ran a hand across his brow.
"My sources tell me that Bettina Trickett took the designs for the bileaflet anginal valves from her husband and gave them to Melville. Melville helped her to sell them on to a big international pharmaceutical company, making a lot of money for himself in the process, which he then invested in becoming the world's environmental conscience. That is the big story, and it should be in the book.
Well, maybe your sources should have written the book.
Latham sighed. He sounded tired. Keith, you're a good writer. Scylla was right about that. The book is yours and no one else's. I just want it to be the best book possible, and if that means facing a few unpalatable truths, then that's the way it has to be. The company is committed to this book. All they ask is that you revisit this area, check your notes, and give Trickett's story the credence it deserves.
He picked up the manuscript.
They've given us a 1 week extension.
Who are they?
They are my board. They pay my wages. And yours.
His voice dropped.
Keith, I need those facts in there. You said to me yourself that a journalist will always look for the truth. Don't resist it, Keith, when it's under your nose. You're a good writer. Now prove that you're a good journalist.
There was, of course, only one person who could definitively scotch the Trickett allegations, and that was the one person Mabbott had agreed not to contact directly. But if he was to have any chance of saving the book as he had written it, he realized he had no option. He called Wendy Liu at her number in Singapore. She greeted him with her usual infectious enthusiasm, and before he could say anything, she had launched into a panegyric about the book, a copy of which had reached her less than a week ago, and which she had immediately sent on to Melville. Mabbott felt compelled to tell her everything that had developed since then. At first, Wendy tried to laugh off Trickett's accusations, but it was clear from the increasing silences that she was taking it all in. Where Mabbott had finished, she was all briskness and efficiency, asking for clarification on certain points, such as dates when things had happened, and the people who had brought this information to Urgent Books. She promised to contact Melville, and said she'd get back to Mabbott with an explanation. Mabbott made it as clear as he could how important it was that he learnt the truth from the man himself. His personal access to Melville was still his trump card. Tuesday and Wednesday came and went. In addition to Rex's testimony, Mabbott re-interviewed his other contacts, none of whom could recollect any dealings between Melville and Trickett. He spent a day at the patent office, painstakingly checking for any submissions Trickett might have made. Trickett had indeed been a fertile inventor, and his name appeared, often with that of his wife, on a number of applications, mainly to do with medical equipment, but there was no mention of bileaflet valves. Interestingly, there had been no applications from him for anything since the mid-1980s. The rest of the week did not go well. Daily calls from Ron Latham and nothing at all from Melville. Scylla Caldwell was uncharacteristically elusive. All he got from her hotel in Madrid were brusque assurances that his messages had been received. On Friday afternoon, an old, rather grubby envelope arrived in the post. It seemed to have been reused several times. Inside was a single sheet of notepaper headed Lease Hall, and a short message which appeared to have been composed on a very old typewriter. It read, "Dear Sir, I have remembered the name of the man who first spoke to me about Bettina. It was a Mr. Latham. Yours faithfully, V. R. Trickett." Mabbott felt paralysed, caught between his desire to be done with the book and have his fees safely banked, and his increasing suspicion that he was being deliberately manipulated by Latham and Urgent to distort the truth. Nevertheless, the very existence of Trickett and Ursula had shaken him and sown doubt where none had existed before. At home, there were other doubts creeping in. Mabbott had been hurt more than he'd expected by the news that Christina and Rex's relationship was not only alive and well, but seemed to be cementing itself around some formless mistrust of his daughter's choice of boyfriend. This only made him more thankful that he had found the money to help Shiraj and his family, and determined to find more if necessary. He knew that Christina wouldn't like it, but that was one of the differences between them. He saw duties, she saw practicalities. It was now Saturday, and Mabbott was sitting stock still in front of his computer, staring at the back of the house opposite, where what had once been a messy green garden had now become a neat paved patio, on which a circular drying device slowly rotated. The doorbell sounded. He walked downstairs. At the door was a young man in well-pressed overalls, holding a small computer terminal. Behind him, a delivery van was double-parked in the street. A car behind it hooted angrily, but the young man seemed in no hurry. He handed over an envelope and requested Mabbott's signature. Mabbott signed, bade him farewell, and was already tearing the envelope open as he pushed the door shut with his foot. To his relief and joy, it was from Melville. At last, handwritten, as before, on old Foreign Office notepaper. With a surge of relief, he took it up to his workroom, shut the door carefully, and sat down to read.
"Keith, greetings. Wendy sent me the book. I'm afraid I could only speed-read it on my way to South America, but it looked pretty good to me. I skipped most of the stuff about my early days, but appreciated the space you gave to my more mature work, and our time in India. I've suggested a few trims of the more personal stuff. Do I really bark orders? But by and large I'm happy, and I congratulate you on an impossible task well executed. This story could make a difference, believe me. Saw Kumar before I left. He sends his best. Hamish M."
Mabbott turned over the paper. The other side was blank. He peered into the envelope, running his finger deep inside. It was empty. He looked for an indication of date or place, but there was neither. He checked his watch. It was 4 o'clock. It would be 11 p.m. in Singapore. He took a deep breath and dialed Wendy's personal number. It was on answer. He left a message, impressing on her as strongly as he could the vital need for up-to-date information from Melville. He had just finished when he was distracted by a shout from downstairs. He opened the door and looked over the banister. Jay had come in. She sounded anxious.
"Have you seen Siraj, Dad?"
Mabbott shook his head. "Not since this morning."
"It's odd. He doesn't usually go out without me, and his bag's not here."
"He's probably gone to the shops, or on one of his marathons.
We always go running together."
"Have you rung his mobile?" She nodded.
"No answer."
"You and me both," Mabbott thought. And for once his tolerance of Melville's lifestyle tipped over into irritation. He might be saving tribes from extinction, but why this obsession with being reclusive? How difficult could it be to make one phone call, for God's sake? "I'm sure he'll be back," he shouted down automatically. Jay didn't reply. He heard her go back into the kitchen. He returned to his workroom and sat staring out at the back gardens again. A pigeon clumsily manoeuvred about his hedge, beak full, looking for a nesting site. He banged on the window, and it flew away. The sound of the phone made him jump. He picked it up quickly, but then his heart sank. It was Ron Latham, and worse still, he sounded happy.
"How's the writing going?"
"Fine," Mabbott lied.
"I have some very good news."
"Oh?"
"Our picture desk has tracked down some shots of Trickett, his wife, and our man together."
"Melville?"
"We're pretty sure it's him. It's a formal photograph at some function, circa 1980. Resolution's not great, but we're working on that."
"I thought you said that Trickett's name wouldn't come out."
"We don't have to say who he is. But everyone will be able to see him. That's not what you promised him."
"Whatever my boys promised him is their affair. I'm a publisher. I have a book to sell. And it's your book, too. Remember that."
"That's why I'm worried."
"Well, don't be. This is just what we need. The camera doesn't lie."
"Unlike you," thought Mabbott.
"Oh, and we sent someone over to that Czech place I can't pronounce.
Carla Vivari.
That's it. So now we have an eye-catching choice of pictures to go with your stuff on the daughter. She's a handsome woman, Keith. She get a free massage?"
"Ron, I don't know what's going on here. She had nothing to say. There's no story there. And as for Trickett, I think he was told what to say."
"Come on, Keith, let's not get into your paranoia. Just put what Trickett told you in the book and let the reader judge for himself."
Mabbott was aware of a mounting anger, desperately trying to find somewhere to settle. "And the photographs?" Latham was trying to sound relaxed, but his voice was high-pitched and brittle. They're part of a very full book. There's a lot of other stuff in there. Some people may not even notice them. Which is why you want to put the photos in, I suppose. Ron, you know as well as I do that this stuff is exactly what the papers, the media, will pick up on. They're not going to be interested in Indian or Brazilian tribes he saved from extinction. If there's a picture of a beautiful blonde outside a health club, that's what they'll print. And once Melville has been discredited by association, then anyone who wants to do some good in the world is going to find it that much harder. Is that really what you want?
Look, no one's talking about discrediting anyone. It's about bringing in the widest audience.
He heard Latham clear his throat. Monday morning, Keith. Full meeting of the board. I have to show them what we've got. This is our last chance. Finish the story the way they want it and have it with me by Sunday night, or the deal is off. Mabbott lowered the phone. He felt his heart thumping. This was turning into a nightmare. Everything he had feared from the first moment he'd set eyes on Ron Latham was coming true. He was slipping into a morass, and he had no idea how to climb out of it. He pulled the window open and took some deep breaths. He had walked into this unholy deal with his eyes wide open, believing somehow that goodness was irreducible. That what Melville stood for was, as nearly as humanly possible, to what everyone should want to stand for. Now it had come to this. Melville was a good man about to be mugged, and he was one of the muggers. He called Scylla in Madrid. This time he didn't even bother to leave a message. Then he returned to his desk and stared out of the window until the dark clouds came and the light began to fade. And finally he set himself to the unwelcome task. It was thoroughly unpleasant work. Having originally written the book in the spirit of Orwell and Norman Lewis, he was finishing it in the style of a Sunday newspaper in a circulation battle. After an hour or two, his motivation evaporated. He persisted, but eventually set it aside, shut his laptop, and went downstairs. No sign of Jay or Shiraj. The house that had once given him so much comfort now felt cold and inhospitable, as if it too disapproved of what he was doing. He looked around him. He hadn't bothered to switch the lights on. All he felt now was an overwhelming desire to be somewhere else. He picked up the phone and called Tess. Chapter 8 Mabbott awoke with a sense of foreboding. Grey daylight drizzled in through half-drawn curtains. He eased himself out of bed, gathered his things and was out of the flat before Tess woke. There was little traffic on the road, and he half walked, half ran along the slumbering back streets till he found a 24-hour corner store on Hornsey Rise. He bought a pint of milk and some orange juice and jogged back to Resserton Road, where he unlocked the front door and entered the house as soundlessly as possible. He held his breath. The house felt different. He went upstairs and onto the landing. Jay's bedroom door was open, so he looked inside. The bed was tidy and hadn't been slept in, and the curtains were open. "Jay," he called as he went downstairs. There was no answer. So they'd both been out for the night. He felt hungry all of a sudden. Hungry for something very basic. Bacon, egg, sausage, anything bad. He walked into the kitchen, taking out his mobile to see whether there had been any word from Singapore. Nothing. Instead, he found two missed calls from the previous night, both from Christina. That was unusual enough to raise a ray of hope. Finding, to his disgust, that there were none of the high cholesterol ingredients he craved, he made himself a large mug of coffee and a tomato sandwich. Then, checking the time, he called his wife.
"There you are."
Never a promising start to a conversation.
"Where have you been?"
she asked.
"In bed. Asleep."
There was the briefest of pauses.
"It's Jay."
His stomach lurched.
"What's wrong?" "Her little Muslim friend."
"Shiraj, what happened to him?"
"You better come over. We're at Rex's flat. 15 Wilton Gardens, Knightsbridge."
Mabbott grabbed his phone, keys and wallet, and ran out into the street. Sunday morning, no cars, let alone a taxi. Maintenance work on the underground. He ran back inside and dialed the local minicab firm. A polite, incurious Somali got him down to Wilton Gardens in 20 minutes. Number 15 was a three-story stuccoed Victorian cottage, with a black front door and matching railings, in a modest but discreetly expensive terrace not far from Harrods. The doorbell nestled in a circular brass cavity, which had been kept well polished. Christina answered the door. She met his eyes briefly, then led him along a narrow hall. Mabbott heard his daughter before he saw her, her whimpering sobs echoing from the kitchen. She was sitting at the table, head bowed, a heartbreakingly fragile figure. She looked up as Mabbott entered, trying and failing to smile.
Dad.
He sat down at the table and took her hand.
What is it, love? Whatever is it?
Rex appeared behind him in a polo shirt and baggy jeans. He looked almost naked without a tie or a jacket. He smiled briskly at Mabbott and moved towards the kettle.
Cup of tea.
Mabbott nodded. Rex put his hand lightly on Christina's shoulder.
Another one, darling?
Christina was seated on the other side of the table from her daughter. She was looking at Mabbott with ill-disguised scorn.
Could someone tell me what's going on?
He asked, looking from face to face. Jay took a deep breath, then shook her head and looked imploringly at Christina. But it was Rex who spoke.
The boy's gone.
The boy? You mean Siraj?
Rex was at the sink, filling the kettle. He turned and nodded.
Gone? Gone where?
Mabbott's voice rose.
Don't tell me, it's the border agency. They've shafted him, haven't they? It's my fault, my stupid fault. I was supposed to drum up support for him. Oh, Jay, love, I'm sorry.
Rex cleared his throat.
It's not the border agency. We don't know what's happened to him. He left a message to say he was sorry, but he had to leave, and that he'd explain one day, but not to try to find him.
Jay gave a low moan. Christina reached across the table and took her hand.
Is he in some sort of trouble?
Jay's mother always had suspicions about him, said Rex. So I made a few inquiries, and one of my contacts, a perfectly trustworthy source, I promise you, warned me that there was a criminal ring operating within London in the Iranian community, obtaining money under false pretenses. One of those on file matched Siraj Fajar's description.
No.
Rex nodded.
They believe his real name is Anik Mehta, and he is an Iranian Kurd.
Are they sure?
Almost certain.
Rex coughed and cast a quick glance at Jay before going on. There's a warrant out for his arrest. Mabbott shook his head in bewilderment.
Do they know his background? What he's been through?
Jay spoke at last.
He lied to me, Dad. And he lied to you.
She hung her head. The tears came again, and this time there was no stopping them. He put his arm around her shoulder. Christina's eyes were hard and cold.
Jay says you gave him £4,000. Mum, is that true?
Yes, it's true. You should be able to get it back.
When he's apprehended, said Rex. But Christina was still staring at her husband.
£4,000? To someone like that?
Mabbott returned her contemptuous gaze.
And I would have given him more if I could.
Oh, well, of course. Now you're a best-selling author. What's £4,000? A drop in the ocean. I gave him the money because I believed him. Just as our daughter believed him. And until I hear a lot more about this, I still believe him.
Christina gave a desperate toss of her head.
Keith, why do you always believe anything except the truth?
Rex took two cups off their hooks above the kettle.
Look, why don't we all adjourn for breakfast? Tea's ready, and I'll put on some toast.
Mabbott thanked him, but declined. He gave his daughter a kiss on the top of her forehead. She took his hand for a moment, and then looked up, as if remembering something.
How's the book, Dad?
Nearly there.
That's good. At least that's one thing I didn't mess up for you.
Christina moved protectively towards her.
Jay's going to stay here with us for a while. She doesn't want to be in the house.
Mabbott nodded.
Of course.
Rex led Mabbott to the front door.
There's no point in my staying. said Mabbott on his way out. Not with Christina the way she is. She's in shock. She'll calm down. Perhaps you could give me a call then? Rex gave a backward glance, then stepped out too, pulling the door almost shut behind him.
Keith, I'm to blame as much as anybody. I should have spoken up much earlier. I've seen a couple of very similar situations. Plausible young chaps with poise and charm. Perfectly decent people taken in. I had doubts about the boy the first time I met him, but as soon as I voiced them, Jay took it personally. And because of my situation with her mother, she and the young man didn't come round much anymore. She compounded the problem by telling everyone it was Christina's fault. All those stories about us splitting up, that sort of thing.
Mabbott looked up the street. Two elderly ladies with bulging green shopping bags were getting into a taxi, giggling like schoolgirls. A group of young men with wayward blonde hair were walking three abreast, fighting each other for possession of the pavement. An immaculate Jaguar XJ turned out of a side road. This was not Mabbott's London, and he wanted to get away. Rex held out his hand.
Ring me any time, if you need to.
They shook. Mabbott paused and looked at Rex.
I still don't believe he was a bad man.
Rex sighed.
That's the skill of these people, I'm afraid.
Back home, Mabbott made himself a cup of coffee, then called Wendy Lou. Her machine said that she was out of the office until Monday, but left no other number. Mabbott thought briefly of ways to poison Ron Latham, or even of running away and leaving his clothes and a note on a beach somewhere. Then, fortified by a second, even stronger cup, he returned to the distasteful task he now had no option but to complete. By late afternoon, what had to be done was done. He read through the rewritten pages without satisfaction. There could be no doubt now that the subject of his book was an all too ordinary mortal, a man who, at one time in his life, had reportedly stolen not just another man's wife, but his life's work as well. No matter how much he used the word alleged, or the well-worn phrase, some say, the damage was clear. Innuendo would do the rest. So now, his side of the contract was complete. Mabbott sat back, numbly, staring into the middle distance. The whole process confirmed that, despite all his grand pretenses, nothing had changed. He remained a hack, a pen for hire. The Melville effect had made fools of them all. His delusions of transforming himself into some latter-day Hamish, helping the helpless, spreading the truth, slaying cynicism in its lair, had turned out to be no more than that. Delusions. And who was he to presume to slay cynicism anyway? A little more cynicism on his part, and his only and dearest daughter might not have ended up sobbing over a kitchen table in Knightsbridge. Stanley, with his unerring sense of occasion, leant against the doorpost and purred with pleasure. At 6, Scylla called. She apologised for not being around during the week. She was glad to hear he'd revised the book. Things had gone well in Madrid. And now she was back, she'd promised Ron that she would come over, collect the new version from Mabbott, and deliver it to him personally. She was just glad to hear that it had all worked out. Chapter 9. When Scylla rang again to say that she would not be with him for another hour, as Hector Fisher was unavailable, it was Sunday night and Hector was evidently a devout churchgoer, Mabbott's misery was merely prolonged. He poured a whiskey, vaguely aware that this was the sort of thing he was doing far too regularly these days, checked for the umpteenth time that the envelope was ready on the hall table, and was about to distract himself with the evening news when the door buzzer sounded. He looked at his watch. It couldn't be Scylla already. He half hoped it might be Jay, but she'd have her own keys. The buzzer sounded again, impatiently. "All right, I can hear you." He opened the front door. A stocky figure stood at the top of the steps, holding a package. "Keith Mabbott, sign here, please." He reached for a terminal and marker and held them out to Mabbott. Mabbott signed completely illegibly, then grabbed the package, slamming the door far harder than he meant to. Inside the jiffy bag was another white envelope. He tore it open, the now familiar handwriting, the Foreign Office notepaper.
the lack of an identifying date or place. He had difficulty holding it steady.
Keith, I've just heard from Wendy of the problems you are having. All I can say is that I'm not surprised. This is why I don't do books. This is why I don't give interviews or go on chat shows. They all have an agenda which is very different from my own. As you know, I have my doubts about urgent books from the start, but I'll come to that later. First of all, the allegations. I owe you an apology for not giving you Ursula or Victor Trickett's name on the list of people you should talk to. They both are, or were, part of my life. Ursula is not the only daughter I have, either. And I would have told you that had we not both agreed that this was not going to be that kind of book. Bettina wanted Ursula to be brought up entirely independent of me, and I have always respected that. Trickett, on the other hand, is a very nasty piece of work, and I would not wish his view of events to go unchallenged. His late wife Bettina was a brilliant woman, a chemist and a physicist with a sharp, highly original mind. I met her through a college friend, and although I won't deny there was a physical attraction, I was chiefly interested in the work she was doing. Bettina was from Yugoslavia, and she came over as a young researcher to Imperial College in 76. She badly wanted to stay and work in London, and to help that process she'd married a colleague by the name of Victor Trickett. He was also a surgical researcher, but he was a plodder. Bettina was the brains. In 1978 she made a breakthrough that later led to the development of bileaflet heart valves. That's a ring, to which two semicircular discs are fitted that open and close to control blood flow. Without her knowledge, Trickett approached a big pharmaceutical company and offered to sell them the technology for a substantial sum of money, portraying himself as the one who'd made the breakthrough. Bettina was, understandably, furious. She was in the course of developing the next stage of anginal valve technology, but now, thanks to Trickett, all her work and her future ideas have been mortgaged off to a company called Bell Laboratories. I had been drifting around the city at the time, as you know, but while most of my friends were looking to invest in bricks and mortar, I was more interested in intellectual property. People doing the sort of things I like to do, thinking outside the box. Independent-minded, difficult bastards. Bettina was one of those. With her cooperation, I raised enough money to buy back the rights to the work she, and to a very limited extent Trickett, had pioneered. Because he had cheated her in the first place, we had to work behind his back and eventually leave the country to avoid the long legal battle that he would undoubtedly have fought. He is not a nice man, Keith. He sent people over to Prague to search the apartment. He made sure Bettina would never be able to work in the UK again. To cap it all, he used work she had done with him to produce heart-lung tubing for which he received a knighthood. For a few years he pursued Bettina through the European courts, but he got nowhere. He produced nothing more, and his career faded into oblivion. I was surprised to hear he was even alive. Bettina worked on in advanced surgical research until she died of breast cancer in 1998. By that time we'd long since gone our separate ways, entirely amicably. This, of course, is my side of the story, and it's entirely up to you whether you believe it or not. But this you should believe, for it's true. When I heard what they were trying to do to your book, I commissioned some research of my own, on your publisher, and the following can easily be checked out. Maybe you've even done so. Urgent Books is a subsidiary of Wide Hat Publishing, wholly owned by the Carlhat Corporation, headquarters in St. Louis, Missouri, and the Cayman Islands. This grand-sounding organization, if somewhat shadowy, is 80% owned by one Carl Hattiker and his family. Along with a few evangelical radio and TV stations, they also own a cereals combine called Hemisphere Grain Group, one of the big wheat cartels that fix prices around the world. Their domination of the market is now being threatened by Russia and China, so HGG are looking to expand elsewhere. One of their biggest, most controversial investments has been to put billions of dollars into the soya fuel market in Brazil. To date,
They are directly responsible for the clearance of 2 to 3% of the Amazon rainforest and the construction of irrigation dams on the Pacachua River that have already destroyed the cultivable land of 30 local tribes. And Brazil is just the current target. They have eyes around the world, constantly on the lookout for the line of least resistance, the corruptible local politicians, the ambitious state governor, the regime that needs to buy tanks and aircraft. Until last year, their operations went almost unnoticed. Then, acting on inside information, my team moved in last August, and within a couple of months, we had enough evidence to convict the company of fraud, corruption, and intimidation. As far as HGG goes, I'm public enemy number one. Do you remember those guys out in Bhubaneswar? The ones who came to the hotel? They were HGG heavies looking for me or my colleagues, and they're becoming increasingly desperate. My guys in Pacachua have had their families threatened. Kids approached at school, for God's sake. Now, wouldn't it just suit them if a best-selling book were to come out showing that the man who has been giving them grief is nothing but a wife-snatching con man? Keith, you're the man in the middle. To reel you in, they had to play on your impeccable liberal credentials and the attraction of my own impeccable liberal credentials to someone like yourself. The problem is that an impeccable liberal book is no good to them. You and I agreed on the things we wanted to say about the earth and how we look after it, and that didn't need dirt. So they've dug up some dirt for you and left it on your doorstep. I happen to know that there's a price on my head now, and being a living legend is not going to protect